Good morning. We're the Historians. I'm Jay Sammons, and I'm here with my longtime friend and Boston University colleague, Professor Brenda McConville.
Coming to you from the banks of the Charles River.
Banks of the Charles. And so I was driving in this morning. You know, I think we forgot to talk about breakfast last week. We got off on weather in New England or something, and maybe we forgot to eat breakfast, which would be disturbing.
Cold temperatures will do that. They impact the mind of the middle class, middle-aged man.
I think you described us both there, but I don't want my mind to be so impacted that I forget about breakfast. So this week, I'm definitely having breakfast, and I'm having two eggs over easy with sausage, and that's it, and some home fries. I'm having a real breakfast. No? Nothing for you?
A bagel and a glass of orange juice.
All right, bagel. Do you put any cream cheese on that bagel?
No cream cheese.
You're not a cream
no,
cheese
no.
Guy?
I do eat butter on there. I do like a little fat in the morning to stabilize me.
I like a little
me.
Fat in every single meal. And my grandfather, Lauren Clarence Sammons, had pork at every meal in his 94 years of existence on this earth.
The pork diet.
I mean, it was a full pork diet, pork all the time, and he was perfectly healthy, pretty much, right up until the moment he checked out.
He might have lived to 104 had he eaten less pork.
No, I don't think that's fair, Professor McConville, at all. He had perfect cholesterol, too. Yeah. Luckily enough, I inherited his cholesterol. I can eat pork and it doesn't affect me. But I don't think we should just continue talking about pork, probably. Maybe we should introduce other subjects.
Not unless we intend to live to be 94 on the pork diet.
So we were going to talk about a particular historian today. I think you suggested this topic, if I'm not mistaken.
I did, but only because you talk about him nonstop, basically.
Well, we thought we'd talk about Edward Gibbon today, who must be, wouldn't you say, the most famous historian in the Anglophone world? Writers of English, is there a historian with Macaulay? Who would we put above Gibbon? I don't really think there's anybody that can touch him.
In fame or in certain category, I would agree with that. I mean, yes, he's one of the great historians.
I mean,
even
most people who can't name a historian might be able to name
Gibbon. I think that's fair.
So many houses, you know, have the history of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire on their shelves.
Even if they've never read it.
Oh, they've never read it. There's no doubt they've never read it. It's a very, very long book, six volumes of decline and fall. You know, it can get a little tedious.
Yes.
I tell my students that Gibbon is the greatest prose stylist in the English language. And, I mean, that's hyperbole, obviously, but I mean them to be shocked by it. And what I tell my students is, when we read Gibbon, when I teach Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, that they should go into the darkest, dankest room in their house with no computer, no phone, nothing but a candle. A candle in the darkest room in your house with your copy of Gibbon, and you must read him for 30 minutes. And if at the end of that 30 minutes you don't like Gibbon, the problem is not Gibbon.
It's you.
The problem is you.
Yeah. Gibbon wrote for a time when people read in a way that we cannot get disconnected, and we're bombarded with images that we, and I would include myself in this, cannot get disconnected, which when I was younger was easier and which I enjoyed.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, we were talking couple of weeks ago about me being in Oxford. And even in Oxford, England, I took a picture while I was there of people sitting in one of the little squares at a monument. And everyone in the picture is on his or her phone. Mm. Every single person in this picture. And there's probably 10 people in the picture.
I always tell my students when they check their Facebook account or check their email, the thing they're going to find out is that nothing interesting has happened to them or their friends. And if I'm really in a bad mood, I say, and nothing interesting ever will.
Oh, Professor McConville. Right. You know, but Gibbon, if you will give him a chance, you have the opportunity to engage with someone who wrote beautiful prose and who was hilarious. One of the things about Gibbon is his sense of humor. And a lot of the humor is in the footnotes, but a lot of it is in the text too. He often has his tongue in his cheek. He's playing with the reader as he moves through his account. And he wrote at a time when history was still supposed to be literature. And this is one of the things that I talk about with almost all of my classes, and maybe we can do a whole show on it one time. What happened to history?
Why did Von Ranke happened?
Von Ranke happened, right. And in the 19th century, the Germans came along essentially, and they killed it.
Right.
They killed it because they wanted to make it into a science,
right.
And thought that they could do that by the accumulation of data and all kinds of other things. That's a subject we should really talk about. But Gibbon is writing before that happens,
right.
And he wanted to write a work of literature, and he expected his readers to appreciate his work as literature, and that means that it's supposed to give you pleasure. That you're supposed to, I always tell my students, if you can imagine this, there was a time when history was supposed to give you pleasure and where you would think, oh, I can't wait to get home so I can open my history, you know, and read the next section. What happens next and how is it going to be described? And Gibbon is fully a part of that world. He's as much a part of that world of the world of Thucydides and Herodotus and the great classical historians who are writing literature as he is of the modern scientific world of history.
Do you fear, as I sometimes do, which we really haven't talked about, but that the purpose of this being connected in electronic tether is to prevent you from having that kind of experience because it removes you from commercial and mass society in a certain way and thus leads you to think in a manner that's not in tune with all that's going on in those realms?
So from a certain perspective, it's dangerous to have people out there reading books and getting pleasure from books in this way because it makes you less of a consumer, for one thing.
Unless you're on Kindle and the commercials are popping up on the side as you try to read.
Which I just, I can't. Yeah.
I can't do it.
I know we sound like a couple of old farts, but it's only because we are.
Yes. I mean, we're old. I think that's the...
We've been teaching for 25 plus years here, 50 plus years in the academy between the two of us, Professor
right.
McConville. But Gibbon gives you that chance to not only escape to a different world, and maybe it's not escape, just to discover another world, but to do it through the prose of an exquisite writer.
To feel the
yes,
other world.
Yes, to feel. And he
both the
you
world
to feel
of
it.
The 18th century and the world of that the Roman decline occurred
right.
in.
So since you mentioned the 18th century, maybe the thing we should do is start out talking about Gibbon's life because he lived in a very, very unusual, interesting life. He was born in 1737 to a family that was of moderate means, of sort of lesser well-to-do means, but they weren't super rich, and they were a very respectable family. But Gibbon was not going to inherit, you know, a huge estate. And he was going to have to do something in his life.
In fact, I believe a member of his family, I believe it was his grandfather had lost money in the South Sea Bubble.
I believe that's right.
Father or grandfather, I can't remember which
I
one.
Think
but
it was
I remember
his,
reading
I think it was his
that.
Grandfather, but it was either his father or his grandfather.
Right.
So it's not any big estate for him to inherit, but they're well enough off that his father wanted him to be educated at Oxford and sent him to Magdalen College in Oxford at the age of 14. If you can imagine.
That was pretty typical at
yes,
that time.
Yes, it wasn't that unusual to right. go off to college very, very young. But Gibbon goes off to college, and he spent 14 months at Oxford, or maybe it was 18 months, about a year and a half, and he said he called it the most idle and unprofitable time of his life.
I don't think that there are many people in college today who could basically argue with that. Yeah. They often feel the same way.
Well, certainly not our students.
No, not at BU.
No. He says, I spent 14 months at Magdalen College. They proved these 14 months proved to be the most idle and unprofitable of my entire life. But he goes on. I'm reading from his memoirs, and I strongly encourage you to pick up Gibbon's memoirs if you haven't, listeners, because they are a wonderful document. He wrote actually several versions of them, and he died with them sort of not reconciled. And so there are various versions of it. This is the Penguin edition that I'm reading from here.
That and Life of Johnson or
Boswell's Life of Johnson who was a contemporary of Gibbon.
Right, another one, yeah, one of many.
So one of the things he talks about, though, when he was at Oxford is the value of a professor, which is an interesting subject. You know, you're laughing, Professor McConville. I think you and I know exactly what the value of a professor is. We could give it in terms of dollars.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, it wouldn't be that high, actually. Right. But one of the things he says is, look, okay, so all these great books have been published, and you know, you would think you could just go read the books on the world, and you don't have to actually engage with teachers. But this is what he says. There still remains a material difference between a book and a professor. The hour of the lecture enforces attendance. Attention is fixed by the presence, the voice, and the occasional questions of the teacher. The most idle will carry something away, and the more diligent will compare the instructions with which they have heard in the school with the volumes which they peruse in their chamber.
That is one of the best descriptions of the value of lectures that I've ever heard. I've read that, but I don't remember that passage.
And one of the things he complains about in his time at Oxford was that the faculty there didn't actually do much teaching. They were very rarely lecturing. They relied on the tutor system, which they still do today, where you spend time, you write essays essentially for your tutor, then you meet with one or two other students. And so he was very upset with the amount of teaching that went on at Oxford. And of course, most of the instructors were monks or clerics, were churchmen. And
they were clerics.
Well,
of some kind.
He calls them monks here. I mean, they're of course,
not Catholic monks, though.
Oh, there were some Catholics at Oxford.
Oh, there were.
Yeah, and that was one of the.
Yeah, no, that's right. You're quite right.
And that was one of the issues, as we're going to see.
Right.
He gets exposed to Catholicism when he's at Oxford. So this is what he says about the teachers. He says, the fellows, or monks, meaning his teachers, of my time were decent, easy men who supinely enjoyed the gifts of the founder. Their days were filled by a series of uniform employments, the chapel in the hall, the coffee house in the common room, till they retired, weary and well satisfied, to a long slumber. From the toil of reading or thinking or writing, they had absolved their conscience, and the first shoots of learning and ingenuity withered on the ground without yielding any fruit to the owners or the public. So there was nothing to be gained from this kind of instruction, he says.
It's nothing like that now, I assure
you.
No, listeners.
Yes, exactly. He goes on to say, the silence of the Oxford professors, which deprives the youth of public instruction, is imperfectly supplied by the tutors, as they are styled, of the several colleges. And then he goes on to describe what happens when you come in and, you know, write essays and spend time with your tutor. He has a long discussion then of his first tutor, who was a guy named Dr. Waldegrave, who he says caused him to read two or three plays of Terence, the Roman comedian, and he says that was the sum total of the work that he says the sum of my improvement in the University of Oxford is confined to three or four Latin plays. And he describes how at one point he showed up at the tutor's session and said, you know, I'm not really prepared today. And the guy said, oh, that's fine. You know, come back tomorrow. And then he wrote a note and said, I can't come tomorrow. I won't be there tomorrow. Oh, that's fine. You know, come next time. And then he wrote another note and he said, well, I can just finally just told the guy,
I'm not coming.
And the guy was perfectly happy with it. That was fine. Right. That was the perfect teaching relationship, apparently, as far as this guy was concerned. But so what happens is he meets some Catholics in Oxford, and he decides he's going to become a Catholic.
It's like becoming a devil worshiper, literally.
It keeps coming back to the historians, this theme over and over again. Of course, England is a Protestant country, and the Church of England is established.
But they all seem to want to become Catholics.
They all want to become Catholics. Gibbon decides that he's going to become a Catholic. And what do you think? How do you think Dad responded to that?
Dad's head explodes. I know about it. And of course, his father completely freaks out and doesn't know what to do about it, and ultimately decides, I'm sending him to Lausanne in Switzerland. Of course, Geneva might have been more appropriate, but he sends him to Lausanne to become a Protestant again.
As one does. Right. You know, when you have a son who's gone Catholic and he's 15 and a half or 16 years old, you send him off to Switzerland where he was going to live with a Protestant minister.
Right.
And I guess you think if you guys living with a Protestant minister in Switzerland, he will not only become a lover of chocolate and clocks, but he will also become a Protestant.
The idea that you could become a public Catholic in England would destroy your family's reputation and your future
your chances to succeed in a public life. And I think that's
your
exactly,
prospects would be gone.
Right. I think that's what concerned his dad.
We're coming up on our first break. We'll be right back. We're the historians.
This is not just any cruise. This is MSC Cruises, one of the largest cruise lines in the world, where every detail is beyond just ordinary. You'll see a different show every night. You'll enjoy freshly prepared international cuisine. Because this is not just any cruise. This is an MSC cruise.
To book your MSC cruise, contact Edgewood Travel Agency at 508-668-2636 or visit edgewoodworldtravel.com.
All right, we're back. We're the historians. We're talking about Edward Gibbon, who has been shipped off to Switzerland to be reconverted to Protestantism by his father, who had freaked out after Gibbon became a Catholic.
It's like becoming a radical Marxist in the 1960s and not wearing clothes, which what people did. Becoming a Catholic is the same for if you were a British and in the middle of the 18th century.
Well, he goes off to Lausanne to live with a Protestant minister there. And and he is eventually converted back to Protestantism, although he's not going to be a fervent a Protestant after this. But he writes with great humor about the house he lived in and the woman, the Madame Pavillard, who was the mistress of this home. He says, the minister's wife governed our domestic economy. I now speak of her without resentment, but in sober truth, she was ugly, dirty, proud, ill-tempered, and covetous. What would he have said about
her? If he had resentment, what would he have added? Warts on her nose? What would have happened there? A unicorn? Right. A horn growing out of her head?
So this is her
earwax? Where would we be going?
Right. So he says, our hours of 12 for dinner, of 7 for supper were arbitrary, though inconvenient customs. The appetite of a young man might have overlooked the badness of the materials and cookery, but his appetite was far from being satisfied with the scantiness of our daily meals, and more than one sense was offended by the appearance of the table, which during 8 successive days was regularly covered with the same linen. So not only is it dirty, not only is the food bad, but the portions are so small.
And the house is dirty.
Right. And if you've seen these pictures, if you've seen pictures of Gibbon, you can see that he was a man who liked his meals.
Oh, yeah. He becomes corpulent.
He becomes very corpulent.
In old age or you know, later on. You know, well, he lives into his mid-50s, 55 or 56, I think. 56 he dies.
So, he liked his meals. But the other thing that happened to him while he's in Switzerland was he meets the woman that he falls in love with. And her name was Suzanne Kershaw.
Right.
And she had two things against her. She was not English, and she was apparently a Catholic, or at least dangerously
close to a Catholic.
And so Gibbon, told his dad that he had fallen in love with this woman, and dad said, no go. You can't marry her. And this, I think, was to Gibbon, a bigger tragedy than his reconversion to Protestantism was that.
Which comes 2 years, it comes in, when does it come? 2 years after he arrives, or a year and a half after he arrives?
It's in that period. I think he was 18 or 19 when he met her for the first time. And this is going to be the love of his life. There's not going to be another woman in Gibbon's life. He says at one point, as a lover I sighed, and as a son I obeyed.
Right.
And then he goes on to write, this woman.
What do you make of that? The fact that he loves this woman, and then later on he writes in a certain way about women, but he becomes friendly with some women, but he never becomes romantically involved again.
I think this forms of, I mean, if we can psychoanalyze Gibbon a little bit, I think this forms a major part of his approach to history. And I think we can show that in a second when we look at the way he treats certain figures in his history, that his life without a wife did really impact him. But he writes very pathetically about this relationship. This woman goes on to marry the Minister of Finance in the French government.
In Louis XVI's government, right.
Who is responsible for calling the Estates General
that
goes on to start the French
Revolution.
Exactly.
Right.
So she marries extremely well. Right. And Gibbon tells a story in his memoirs about going to visit her after she was married and visiting her and her husband, and that he was sitting downstairs with the husband and wife, and the husband at one point got up and said, well, I'm going to go to bed now, and he retires. And Gibbon writes in a letter to one of his friends that this was the greatest insult he had ever received, because the husband was basically saying, I'm not worried about my wife still being in love with you. Right. I can leave the two of you alone, and I'll just go to bed.
Right.
So Gibbon was insulted by that. So you see how deeply he still felt this, you know.
It is interesting, as I mentioned to you before we began to record, John Locke had a sort of similar pattern in his life. He never married. He was in love with a woman, and then the daughter of a Neoplatonist. That is interesting.
daughter of a Neoplatonist around,
right? Who was pretty formidable thinker on her own. But when he returned from his exile after the Glorious Revolution in England, they live together in a kind of platonic relationship, and he describes it as a very happy time of his
life. A platonic
life.
Or a neoplatonic?
A platonic relationship with a Neoplatonist. Yes, that was his fate. But it is interesting to me, Hobbes, Locke, Milton, Gibbon, how much time they spent alone.
Yes.
And that is so central to mm-hmm. understanding. Milton less, but he does, and he ultimately goes blind. It's central to who they are.
Well, I think with Gibbon, you can see how this these two things, his giving up of Catholicism, which he had accepted, and his giving up of this woman that he loved, affects the way he treats the two real heroes of the early part of his work. Now, the first volume of The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire was published in 1776.
Right. It is interesting. He becomes a member of Parliament in 1774 in time for the imperial crisis.
Yep.
When the empire ruptures, and then he publishes the first volume in 1776, and that is clearly part of its fame. No matter how great a writer he is, which really is a great writer, its fame is because it was seen in light of what was happening to what we call the first British Empire, of course.
And it's the same year that Adam Smith published The Wealth,
Wealth of Nations.
And I mean, so this, I always ask my students, you know, what happened in 1776, you know, and they'll say something about the American Revolution, but no, it's really Adam Smith and Edward Gibbon.
Right.
He joins Parliament in 1774 and served for 8 years
right.
without ever addressing the body.
Right.
He never said a word.
He was a client of Lord North, who was the Prime Minister during the American Revolution. Yeah, and in fact, Lord North, he's not elected from the same, I believe, from the same district the second in 76 when he's reelected. Mm-hmm. It's from somewhere else that North controls. I believe that.
One of these rotten boroughs.
Right. I've read a lot about it, but in the past. Far enough in the past.
Yeah. So two of the two figures that I think he focuses on in his early part of his history, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, both 4th century AD figures. One is a Christian bishop named Athanasius, who was the Archbishop of Alexandria and is considered sort of the real father of the canon of Scripture as it's recognized today. Athanasius is the first person to put the books of the Old and New Testament together and say, these are the books that ought to be in the Christian Bible.
These are the ones that are excluded.
And these are the ones that are excluded. Now, other people had very, very similar lists. It's not that there was that much in dispute in the 4th century AD. There wasn't much in dispute. But Athanasius asserts this, and after his assertion of it, it becomes standard. But the main thing he's famous for is that he was a rabid Trinitarian.
Right.
He believed in the equivalency of the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost.
Right.
Believe it or not, the Trinity, which is, of course, Orthodox Christianity today, was still very much up in the air in the 4th century A.D.
Threatened by both the Arian and by various Manichaean right. heresies, correct?
Manichaeans are dualists right. who divide the world into spirit and flesh, and there were Manichaean Christians.
Right.
Augustine was one before he became an Orthodox Christian.
Right.
And the Arians were Christians who did not believe in the Trinity. They believed that Jesus was born. There was a time when he was not, is what they said.
Right.
The Son is less than the Father.
Right.
The Father generates the Son.
Right.
So Athanasius was a strong, strong Trinitarian. And Gibbon's account of his adventures, I always tell my students, Gibbon treats Athanasius as the first international man of mystery. Because he really is. He goes on the lam. He's pursued by... But what happens is that the Roman government becomes anti-Trinitarian.
Right.
Constantine the Great's son, Constantius, is not a Trinitarian Christian, and he persecutes Trinitarians.
He's an Arian, is not?
He's an Arian.
Right.
He persecutes Trinitarians. Athanasius has to go on the run and has these incredible adventures where he's, gets out of cities by being packed into pots and lowered over the edge of buildings. He pretends to be other people. He shows up at conferences where nobody expects him to be.
I've done that myself.
I mean, he's, right. He is literally in fear for his life, but he refuses to give up this Trinitarian stance.
Gibbon captures this brilliantly.
Oh,
it's brilliant, the writing there.
And so the way I look at this is, why does he admire Athanasius so much? We can talk about Gibbon and Christianity in the next segment. But I think what he admires about Athanasius so much is that he was unwilling to compromise. That is, he does not do what Gibbon did, which was to give up his faith and to give up his love.
Don't you think, though, that It's interesting. You say that as well. It has to do with his relationship to women. I think of it as having to do with a relationship with his father.
Yeah.
That his father was this authoritarian figure that forced him into compromises that he didn't want. And he felt like, I'm too weak. I did the wrong thing and made myself unhappy. And I deserve to
be
unhappy.
That's a great point. I wouldn't say a word against it. But Gibbon goes so far to praise Athanasius. And this is someone who has ambivalent feelings about the Christian church, understand. He says, amidst the storms of persecution, the Archbishop of Alexandria was patient of labor, jealous of fame, careless of safety. And although his mind was tainted by the contagion of fanaticism, Athanasius displayed a superiority of character and abilities which would have qualified him far better than the degenerate sons of Constantine for the government of a great monarchy. He would have been a better emperor than Constantine's sons. This is what Gibbon says about Athanasius. But I do think the thing with women does come in with this, because one of the things that Gibbon talks about is Athanasius' involvement with women. And so what do we mean by that? Well, one of the things he does is when he's hiding, when he's running around, he's hiding with monks. All the Trinitarians are hiding him hither and thither, and he's being chased by the imperial forces. Gibbon says, his various adventures might have furnished the subject of a very entertaining romance. He was once secreted in a dry cistern, which he had scarcely left before he was betrayed by the treachery of a female slave. He was once concealed in a still more extraordinary asylum, the house of a virgin, only 20 years of age, who was celebrated in the whole city for her exquisite beauty. So this is the setup. Athanasius shows up, all right, at this house of this 20-year-old beauty. At the hour of midnight, as she related her story many years afterwards, she was surprised by the appearance of the archbishop in a loose undress, who, advancing with hasty steps, conjured her to afford him the protection which he had been directed by a celestial vision to seek under her hospitable roof. The pious maid accepted and preserved the sacred pledge which was entrusted to her prudence and courage. Without imparting the secret to anyone, she instantly conducted Athanasius into her most sacred chamber and watched over his safety with the tenderness of a friend and the assiduity of a servant. As long as the danger continued, she regularly supplied him with books and provisions, washed his feet, managed his correspondence, and dexterously concealed from the eye of suspicion this familiar and solitary intercourse between a saint whose character required the most unblemished chastity and a female whose charms might excite the most dangerous emotions. During the 6 years of persecution and exile, Athanasius repeated his visits to his fair and faithful companion. Right? So, now, Gibbon is playing with us here, right? He's suggesting, well, did something go on here? Maybe, maybe not. But at least on the surface of it, Athanasius retains his
virtue.
His virtue, even with these terrible temptations. Well, the other hero that Gibbon really seizes on in the 4th century AD is the Emperor Julian,
right.
Julian the Apostate.
Right.
Who ruled from 361 to 363 and was the great enemy of Christianity, and who basically tried to remove. Christianity had become essentially the official religion of the Roman Empire, not legally, but it was patronized by the state. And
was in all areas of the empire by that point.
Absolutely. Right. And Julian tries to reverse that. And Julian tries to establish a kind of pagan church that could rival. Julian was raised as a Christian. And when he becomes emperor, he comes out, as it were, as a pagan, and rejects his Christianity. But what he does is he looks at the Christian church and says, these guys have their organization together. We better have something like this. And he tries to establish a pagan church modeled on Christian organization.
Right.
And he makes it illegal for Christians to teach in the public schools. That was his
most
famous.
Did he try to restore the ancient gods?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, he did try to restore the ancient gods.
But he tried to restore them in a very weird way that annoyed even the pagans. And we're coming up on a break, I see. But the pagans felt as if he was trying to impose a kind of pagan Christianity on them, because he thought that we should have priests who should be pious and shouldn't go to the games and essentially should be holy men like Christian priests were.
Like Christian preachers, but not Christian preachers.
Exactly. And the pagans said, hey, Julian, you've missed the whole point, right?
Of paganism.
Exactly. You've missed the point of paganism.
We're up on the break. We're the historians.
You're listening to The Historians every Saturday from 8 to 9 a.m., right here over WNTN and streaming worldwide at WNTN1550AM.com, all part of the Global Echoes Radio Network, Boston's hub for international radio.
There's an old New England saying for just about everything in life, but our favorite is this one. Use only the finest 100% Arabica beans. We're the New England Coffee Company, and we've been perfecting the art of coffee roasting for over 85 years. All that experience has created a reputation for exceptional coffee, so that every cup is rich, satisfying, delicious, in the New England tradition. New England Coffee, available at your local supermarket.
We're back. We're the historians.
We're discussing Edward Gibbon.
Edward Gibbon. But before we get back to Gibbon, we better talk about our historical sponsor today, which is Shakespeare and Associates. Brendan, you know that identity theft is a major problem in our modern society, but did you know it was also a problem in 16th century Europe?
I did, but only in a general sense.
Okay. Well, who are you going to call if your identity or your intellectual property has been stolen?
Shakespeare and Associates.
Shakespeare and Associates, that's right. Shakespeare and Associates, specializing in cases of plagiarism, copyright infringement, and, strangely, false imprisonment. Shakespeare and Associates have been defending the intellectual property of their clients since 1609, when the firm was established by royal charter under James I as the King's Barristers, Lincoln Inn. In an early case, Pentateuch versus His Royal Majesty James I, Shakespeare and Associates successfully defended the translators of the King James Bible against the charge of simply and literally, quote, translating without alteration or literary and aesthetic addition the Hebrew Old Testament. Shakespeare and Associates proved beyond any reasonable doubt that the King James Bible was in fact a work, quote, wholly and entirely new, close quote, and, quote, only coincidentally treating subjects, persons, and deities found in any previous publication. Although the Archbishop of Canterbury, in an amicus brief, vigorously disputed this claim, famously calling it a load of tosh and rubbish. In their most infamous case, Shakespeare and Associates defended the Globe Theatre Company in a class action suit brought by Edward de Vere, Francis Bacon, Ben Jonson, Walter Raleigh, and Christopher Marlowe, claiming that more than two-thirds of the plays attributed to, quote, one William Shakespeare had in fact been stolen from or written by one of the plaintiffs. The court found in favor of the defendant, although the presiding judge commented, quote, that whoever, quote, whoever wrote Timon of Athens and the second half of Julius Caesar deserved to be hung by the neck until dead, close quote. So if you have worries about identity theft or the loss of your intellectual property, contact Shakespeare and Associates today. And remember that a rose by any other name may swell as sweet, but noses don't make legal judgments.
Shakespeare and Associates, when you fear the Earl of Oxford.
Wonderful. I think that's a great sponsor for us to have today in this world. I'm worried about having my intellectual property stolen. I don't know about you.
I worry about it every day.
Exactly. So bringing up Gibbon and Julian, it gets us into the subject of Julian of Gibbon and Christianity. But before we leave his relationship with this Emperor Julian, I just want to bring back this thing, to go back to this thing about women. Because one of the things he says is very telling about the Emperor Julian here. This is, again, quoting from Gibbon. He says he was a guy who didn't like to eat. He was an abstemious eater. The supper of the emperor was still less substantial than the former meal. His sleep was never clouded by the fumes of indigestion. And except in a short interval of a marriage, which was the effect of policy rather than love, the chaste Julian never shared his bed with a female companion. Yeah. So Gibbon is idealizing here this idea of not being
this lifestyle. Yeah,
yeah. We talked about Caesar and Augustus and had our big debate about the greatest men of antiquity. Gibbon's summation of Julian's character is quite interesting. He says, when we inspect with minute or perhaps malevolent attention the portrait of Julian, something seems wanting to the grace and perfection of the whole figure. His genius was less powerful and sublime than that of Caesar, nor did he possess the consummate prudence of Augustus. The virtues of Trajan appear more steady and natural. The philosophy of Marcus is more simple and consistent. Yet Julian sustained adversity with firmness and prosperity with moderation. After an interval of 120 years from the death of Alexander Severus, the Romans beheld an emperor who made no distinction between his duties and his pleasures, who labored to relieve the distress and to revive the spirit of his subjects, and who endeavored always to connect authority with merit and happiness with virtue. even faction and religious faction, was constrained to acknowledge the superiority of his genius in peace as well as in war, and to confess with a sigh that the apostate Julian was a lover of his country and that he deserved the empire of the world.
Powerful, another powerful passage. It certainly does seem to parallel his own situation in life in some respects.
Yeah. So, of course, Gibbon could look at a Christian, someone he calls someone motivated by fanaticism, Athanasius, and treat him as a heroic figure. And then he can also look at Julian, who is the great enemy of Christianity, and treat him as a heroic figure. And I think this is one of the reasons that when people read the first volumes of his work, they were concerned about Gibbon's attitude towards Christianity.
I think that there's a tendency among scholars of the 18th century to see him as a product of the Enlightenment, in quotes, without really defining what that means, which is very common among scholars. They're constantly saying, this person or that person is involved in the Enlightenment, but that doesn't really describe their beliefs. And that happens to Gibbon all the time, right. All the time.
Yeah. Well, what he does in his chapters on Christianity, which were chapters 15 and 16 of the original work, what he says is, listen, I'm not going to treat the question of what role the divine played in the rise of Christianity and how Christianity became successful. He says, I'm going to treat what he calls the secondary causes of Christianity's success. He essentially takes the issue of Christianity's truth off the table. And then he looks at five issues that he says were secondary causes leading to the success of Christianity. The inflexible zeal of the Christians, Christian strength, the doctrine of a future life,
right?
Miraculous powers ascribed to the early church. He doesn't take a position on whether these miracles actually happened or not. He just says people believe them. The pure morals of the Christians, and the union and discipline of the Christian Republic, that is the organization of the church itself. Right. Yeah. And we could add 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 other things to that list, but that's a pretty darn good list,
right,
for a historian who's trying to analyze the human factors involved in the success of Christianity. Yeah. But that got him in trouble because he seems to be taking the religion itself, the truth, quote unquote, of the religion, off the table.
This was a debate throughout the 18th century, the debate between Orthodox Protestants of, people who were seen as having what they could consider Orthodox Protestant beliefs, and those in the Anglo-American world who deviated from that in one way or another. They were in America, they were in England, they were in Scotland, they were in Ireland, they were everywhere. They were also in Europe, a number of these people, European figures. It is interesting, at different times they're much more, in other words, certain publications and at certain times people are quite sensitive about these issues, and at other times they recognize them, but they're more relaxed about them. They're never happy about it. The vast majority of people were Protestant.
Yeah.
Of course, there were Catholics in Ireland and Catholics in the north of Scotland, but the vast majority of people in the English-speaking world were Protestants.
Well, I think Gibbon, one of the things he says in his memoirs is when he got this negative reaction and people writing reviews saying he's hostile to Christianity, one of the things he said in his memoirs was, if I had realized that most Englishmen were even attached to the name of Christianity, then I might have changed my chapters. In other words, I look around me and I see a bunch of hypocrites, people who claim to be Christians but don't live this kind of life, and now they're angry at me because I'm not, towing the line, whatever that line was supposed to be, on the analysis of Christianity. So the hypocrisy he saw around him really did bother him.
One of the things I would point out, though, is that in this period, as the empire ruptures, there's a fear that the leadership of the empire has been corrupted by enlightened ideas or by Catholicism. And, of course, Gibbon is vulnerable to that.
He is.
And he's vulnerable to that criticism. And that criticism leads to the Gordon Riots, which are one of the most vicious anti-Catholic pogroms in 18th century England, if not the most vicious. Hundreds of people are killed in this. And a lot of it has to do with the belief that the leadership has become soft on Catholicism and has entertained heretical beliefs. And there was also tensions over that within the American Revolutionary camp, which is episode 10, which is about my little book on North Carolina. My little book on North Carolina is in part about this, mm-hmm. how it works itself out on the social level. People feared these beliefs, and they feared people like Gibbon, who seemed to be saying, I'm not of this.
Right.
And it depended, again, writing when he did, publishing when he did, the issue was in play. And then it goes further into play as the French Revolution reels into anti-clericalism and anti-Christianity later at the end of his life.
And Gibbon does express he's repulsed by the French Revolution. Right. He's not a supporter of it at all. But to be fair to Gibbon's critics, He cannot resist a good joke. And you see what he did with Athanasius, implying that he's in this house of this right. beautiful virgin or whatever. And so he can't resist when he sees something that is funny. He and this is a classic example and has to do with Christianity. This is about the 3rd century AD theologian Origen. And Origen was a Christian Platonist. But Origen's the most famous act of Origen was that he castrated himself. All right. And so Gibbon is talking about Origen, and he says, since desire was imputed as a crime and marriage was tolerated as a defect, it was consistent with the same principles to consider a state of celibacy as the nearest approach to divine perfection. It was with the utmost difficulty that ancient Rome could support the institution of 6 Vestals. They were supposed to be chaste, the Vestal Virgins. But the primitive church was filled with a great number of persons of either sex who had devoted themselves to the profession of perpetual chastity. A few of these, among whom we may reckon the learned Origen, judged it most prudent to disarm the tempter. All right? Now, the footnote here is Gibbon's footnote. And Origen was famous for allegorizing Scripture, right? So Gibbon in the footnote says, as it was his general practice to allegorize Scripture, it seems unfortunate that in this instance alone he should have adopted the literal sense. The literal sense being the verse, if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out.
Right.
Now, the footnote is unnecessary to the point, right? But Gibbon can't resist. This guy allegorizes Scripture, but he takes the one Scripture, if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. That's the one he takes literally. So, you know, you could see how this could get him into trouble. But he survived it, and his work is immensely popular. Right.
Of course, there were critics.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
One thing I did want to point out, as we were talking about as we were preparing to come on, some of his contemporaries, Adam Smith, Edmund Burke, David Hume, Adam Ferguson, Horace Walpole, William Blackstone, Catherine Macaulay, Joseph Priestley, Benjamin Franklin, people who were in London at this time.
Samuel Johnson. Whose literary club he was a member of, right. And so was Adam Smith. So he's not just living in the same time as these guys.
Right.
He's actually meeting them.
Right. James Berg, the political philosopher and dissenting minister.
Now, I can't remember, is Franklin the one supposedly, I don't know if this is an apocryphal story.
It is. It's apocryphal. Probably, where he says, way to have material on the decline and fall of the British Empire, and he jokes about it.
No, the story I'm remembering is somebody who comes up to Gibbon in the midst of the publication, the mini-volume publication of work, and goes, scribble, 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 eh, Gibbon?
I don't know if that was Franklin.
Okay, all right.
That doesn't sound like Franklin. Franklin joking about the decline and fall of the British Empire. That sounds like Franklin.
Yeah, that's funny. These guys are all running into each other in London, going to the same clubs. It's just
Burke was in Parliament. I mean, it's an incredible roll call of people. Plus, you have people like Lord North, all these other people who were involved in the American Revolution. It's an incredible roll call of thinkers, and it shows you, just as in our previous episode we were discussing Athens and its literary and artistic groups, the 18th century empire attracted all kinds of people, and they moved to London or the London area, and they lived an incredible life of intellectual ferment.
But just so we don't get too intellectual a picture of what was going on at this time, Gibbon also had to serve in the militia.
Yes.
The county militia.
In the period where they feared a French invasion during the Seven Years' War, between 59 and 62.
So he describes, this is in his memoirs again, his commander was a guy named Sir Thomas Wolseley. He says, Sir Thomas Wolseley was an easy, good-humored man, fond of the table and of his bed. Our conferences were marked by every stroke of the midnight and morning hours, and the same drum which invited him to rest has often summoned me to the parade. His example encouraged the daily practice of hard and even excessive drinking, which has sown in my constitution the seeds of gout.
he became corpulent in old age, Gibbon, and had gout and all these other diseases associated with being large.
Yes, he did. And one that ultimately killed him was...
At a relatively young age.
We won't go into the details of it, but you can read Gibbon's memoirs. But it involved a collection of fluids in a part of your body where you do not want a large collection of fluids. And it was the treatment for this that ultimately he got an infection, it seems, when the treatment, because, of course, there was no way to prevent this. And dies at this relatively young age. I believe his last meal consisted of a chicken wing and two glasses of Madeira.
Really? Yeah. Is that
right?
Is
one
that
of his, one of his Lord Sheffield, I think.
Lord Sheffield was his close friend, right? Yeah. He dies at Lord Sheffield's house, if I recall that from years ago. Yeah. Again,
Sheffield is the account of his death that I've read, and he was certainly, you know, with him or near him. Sheffield was the one who tells us what his last meal was.
Let me ask you this.
Oh, we're coming up on a break, though. Maybe we should take a break and then come back.
We'll be right back. We're the historians.
Ocean Spray, a grower-owned corporation providing you nutritious, all-natural benefits since 1930. Stop at your local supermarket and pick up a bottle of Ocean Spray cranberry juice today, and visit their website at www.oceanspray.com to find additional recipes for various desserts, cocktails, and appetizers. Benefits go a long way with Ocean Spray.
All right, welcome back. We're the historians. For any information on the historians or any program on WNTN Global Echoes Radio, visit our website, WNTN1550AM.com, and you can reach us by emailing therealhistorians@gmail.com. So we killed off Edward Gibbon in the last segment.
Chicken wings and Madeira, right?
I know, it seems so unfair, but I certainly would, before we get to this week in historical news, I would strongly encourage our listeners to pick up an edition of Edward Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. If you want to read beautiful English prose and get humor, you really can't do better than Edward Gibbon.
Incredible stylist. Yeah. Incredible.
And we remember from an earlier episode that Gibbon was one of the rare writers in the 18th, 19th, and even early 20th centuries that took a rather negative view of Augustus Caesar, that he took that from the ancient historian Tacitus, and that theme is picked up by Ronald Syme in his book The Roman Revolution. So Gibbon forms a part of this amazing triumvirate of great Roman historians, Tacitus, Gibbon, and Ronald Syme.
Listeners, as you know, I know they're wrong. I've already proclaimed Augustus the greatest man of antiquity, and that will stay.
So the triumvirate of Tacitus, Gibbon, and Syme cannot stand before the monarchy of McConville.
Exactly. Before we move on, I did want to ask. I would first note that John Pocock, who's one of the great intellectual historians of the latter half of the 20th century in the English language, originally a New Zealander, he has written extensively about Gibbon and about Decline and Fall. It's a multi-volume set. Barbarian. The title is
Pocock.
Pocock and Gibbon. Go online and
I don't know that work. It sounds like something I should read.
You absolutely should read it. He worked on it forever, and he has since worked on it. He's now in his 90s. He continued to work on it until relatively recently, and I thought perhaps he let it run too long, but it's still fascinating. Work definitely worth reading. It's a multi-volume thing. That's why I can't remember the single title. There's a single overarching title, but their different volumes have slightly different titles, and really is fascinating.
Well, Pocock is somebody I've heard you speak positively about over the years.
One of the great thinkers himself. He lacks Gibbon's literary skills, but has the same level of penetration.
No.
Yeah, quite. His literary skills are far inferior, but his mental processes are the same.
I don't think many of us are going to stack our literary skills up against Gibbon.
So. Right. I would ask him, but I think that we want to come back and talk to him this more about how Gibbon has been used in this whole issue of Decline and Fall. And I think we've returned to that in another episode.
Yes.
Talk about the issue of Decline and Fall as part of our ongoing conversation about the Roman Republic and the Roman Empire, which is one of the themes of the show.
Right. Theories about why the Roman Empire collapsed. This is another good place where we can talk about Gibbon and the other ancient historians of Rome.
We're up to This Week in Historical News.
My favorite segment. I'm very excited.
First, I want to call people's attention to a piece. It was from the New York Post Sunday, November 12th. It was about two fellows. I am from the New York area. I'm from northern New Jersey. I am an ardent Giants fan, even in this catastrophic season, which has seen us humiliated one week after another, getting me very excited here.
Yeah, it doesn't look good for the Giants.
Doesn't look good.
I don't think you guys are making the playoffs.
But this is about two guys, and the reason why it really stuck out to me, other than they were Giants who had played during the time of in the 1930s and 40s, one is from Jersey City, and the other one attended Baylor. Yeah, so I am from
For the Giants.
Yeah, my family's from Jersey City originally, and Professor Sammons attended Baylor as an undergraduate. These two men, one of them is named Al Bozis, I'd never heard of him. He joined the Army. He was 6 foot six, and he was considered too big, which was common then for the Army. In other words, you're just too big. And he insisted on joining. He played for the Giants at the opening of the war. He then was, sort of insisted on being joining the Army. He joined the Army. He was then insisted on being transferred to a combat unit, which was, again, he was in a non-combat role. He was killed in France at the end of the Battle of the Bulge in one part of the frontier between France and Germany. He was killed in combat. Another fella...
So he left his professional football career.
He left his professional football career behind. He went into the Army. He insisted on being put into combat, and then he was killed in combat.
Why is this story in the news now?
Jack Loomis was the second of these guys. He had attended Baylor. He was a receiver for the Giants. He joined the Marines, and he was killed on Iwo Jima. Why they brought this? The writer in the newspaper is Phil Musnick. He's a well-known writer in the New York area. Has worked for several newspapers. Several ships have been named in his honor. One of these fellas, Loomis, the second one, the guy who played wide receiver, won the Congressional Medal of Honor on Iwo Jima. He had his legs blown off by a landmine. He was killed there. He continued to command his men with no legs. They storm this situation.
Good heavens.
Why do I bring this up? It struck me, first, it was an unusual piece for them to put in. In other words, these are two unknown guys who've played for the Giants. But I thought it was appropriate to today's episode because Gibbon's ideas about the decline of virtue. Many of the people who were in the NFL joined the military during World War II, and same with professional baseball, professional basketball. All these people who were around joined the military. Only one person by the time of Vietnam from the NFL fought in Vietnam. Wow. Can you name that person?
From the Vietnam era, no.
Rocky Blyer. He played running back. He was served in Vietnam. His leg was partially blown off. The Maras, who are the family who owned the Pittsburgh Steelers, wrote to him while he was in the hospital recovering saying, hey, even though at that time they didn't even know if he would walk again, he had been drafted by the Steelers and then said, no, I'm going to serve in the military. He got drafted into the Army. Almost at the same time, they said, we need a tough guy on this team. Even though they knew his leg had been partially blown off, he recouped himself and played in the NFL for 10 years after that.
He had a heck of a career.
But it's a change in the nature of civic virtue in the sense that during the World War II generation, it was conceived of, okay, you're a professional athlete. You're the son of the president. It doesn't, or the son of a former president. It doesn't matter. You need to serve. By the time of the Vietnam era, that had clearly declined. Of course, it was the nature of the struggle in part, but there are deeper issues. We've talked about this before.
We have, and think about it too, the way we did this to ourselves in a way by exempting people who were going to college and drafting people who weren't, creating this terrible distinction, which was largely economic, between the people who are going to do the dying and the people who aren't. And then there's the whole issue of the war itself, which wasn't supported by great swaths of the country.
And which was being led by cynical political leaders for political purposes.
Yeah, but that's quite a story.
It is an incredible story of these two men, and it was great that they included that. Again, it's the New York Post, Sunday, November 12th. There's several pieces about the influence. This one is from the November 11th Financial Times about the influence of the opening of Japan in the middle of the 19th century by the Americans, initially the black ships, Commodore Perry, on the artistic world of London and on the artistic world in Europe, and particularly that the flowers of Japan began to become incorporated into European art, and that this sort of is this unintended. Of course, we laugh, but much of
no. I'm thinking about the Dutch and the tulips.
I'm coming, to that. The claim of this writer, Robin Lane Fox, on gardens is that much of the English garden was also shaped by this, as well as the artwork, the Japanese influence in the 19th century. And I think that this struggle over the character of the English garden is related to Brexit, that they're trying to define it in relationship, whether it's really English or what are the foreign influences. Somehow, I think, but it is a crisis in the English press. I mean, Financial Times is a fairly liberal, but there's a paper, but it's also in the conservative press over what is the character of the English garden, what influences are at work on it, how does it influence the artistic world, what flowers get painted.
Let me ask you this. How many students are writing dissertations right now on flowers and political interpretation? You know that's being done. You know there are sociologists, et cetera. No, we got time.
Oh.
Let me just say, Robin Lane Fox, who wrote that article, wrote a biography of Alexander that Ernst Badian of Harvard savaged in the Journal of Hellenic Studies around about 1975. It's one of the most famous reviews in ancient history because it's so incredibly brutal.
Oh, sounds fantastic. I wish people have complained about me as a brutal reviewer on another Harvard
professor.
That's what
Greek historians do. We destroy each other.
Yeah. Sadly, we don't do enough of that in early American field. You have to find a balance. The urge to destroy is also the urge to create.
Yes.
You know?
No. I don't believe in balance when it comes to reviews.
A piece in the October 14th Economist about the Dutch painter Vermeer and whether his painting was really Dutch or had English influences.
They
are fighting over this who created what art issue.
You know, the Dutch are creating so many troubles on the historians. They just keep coming back over and over again. It's the Dutch painters, the Dutch tulips, and the Dutch nutmeg.
The claim that Vermeer, of course, is one of the most famous of them, Dutch painters, the claim was always that he led a kind of monastic life, that his painting is a result of his own genius. And there's an exhibition in Washington, D.C. at the National Gallery. It had also been in Paris and Dublin, the same exhibition being shown, that claims that no, he was influenced by both British and Spanish painters, and that he's not an individual genius.
This is a straw man argument. All painters are influenced by other painters. This is ridiculous. The idea that he locked himself up in some garret and manufactured his style out of whole cloth, that's just completely unbelievable on its face.
The Economist writer says, I don't give the who it is, I don't believe we need to tell people that Vermeer was an exceptional artist because people can see that for themselves. Instead, the show reveals how a genre painter in dialogue with contemporaries can still tower above them, which is certainly true.
Yes,
I mean,
it's true. We're doing well.
We've
got about three or four more minutes, Professor McComb.
There was a piece in the November 12th Boston Globe, Sunday Globe, about NATO and whether NATO is headed for a breakup. And the thrust of the piece, the tensions between the United States and whether we want to continue in NATO, of course, this has become an issue in the Trump administration, but also it's by a guy named Stephen Kinzer. He's a Brown, associated with Brown University. We don't know him. but he basically says that, look, part of the issue is that Turkey is now, because of its leadership, Erdogan sees itself as a more Middle Eastern rather than European country, which it did when the Ottoman Empire collapsed. They were tried to Europeanize. Mm-hmm. And he talks about the roots of this and that the leadership in Turkey in the first half of the 20th century wanted to Europeanize, but the mass of the people really still saw themselves as Islamic and mm-hmm. of that area, and that tension is causing the tension within NATO, and that in essence, NATO, which has been with us since 1949, is under pressure because Turkey, its cultural direction and its orientation has moved away from Europe and moved away. And, of course, I think this is true, but he does do a good job of sort of situating. And he talks about how Ataturk seized power during the 1920s and that Turkey should move away from the Mideast, which he saw as backwards, and towards a modern Europe. Of course, a small piece of Turkey is in Europe. But Turkey should not be this backward country, and Turkey should be a part of NATO. And
you could say a small piece of Turkey is in Greece.
Right. Certainly many Greek people would say that.
Yes, I would say that, too.
But he says, look, NATO will not be the same, and that this cultural sort of reassertion of Islam within Turkey is going to change many relationships in that part of the world and beyond. And I believe that to be true. I think if Turkey is no longer part of NATO, and of course you can see in the crisis in Syria, Turkey tried to steer its own course. They had to because of the turmoil to the south of them, that changes fundamentally the diplomatic and military situation in many parts of the world.
It also relates to what we discussed last week briefly, which was the Kurdish situation,
right,
and whether they're going to be allowed to have their own state or some kind of enclave anyway.
Certainly, Erdogan and the Turkish leadership is hostile to the support the Kurds have gotten. We're nearly at the end. There's one more piece I have to discuss. There is a piece of Van Gogh artwork, famous, The Olive Trees, which you'll recognize. You recognize
this. I see it in you, yes.
Yeah. The Olive Trees. People have studied it since 1889, its brilliance, the colors, the textures. It turns out that one of the texts, which no one could ever interpret correctly, was actually a small rogue
grasshopper that flew into the paint and was covered over by Van Gogh, who clearly wasn't always stable, and covered over and made part of the painting. Van Gogh painted this poor grasshopper into the olive trees. It was finally recognized now after 100 years that a poor grasshopper had been, you know, is basically part of that texture.
Brendan, he gave his life for art.
A noble end for a six-legged creature.
All right. And on that note, I think we'll have to say goodbye.
We're the Historians.